Hello and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you'll learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
If you have your Bibles, would you open them? We're in the book of Revelation, chapter 7. For the past couple of days, our country has been watching as Hurricane Florence pounded the Carolinas. And I'm told it is the largest hurricane this year. The storm surge alone is expected to be over 9 feet in some places, and it just drives home the point that hurricanes are the most destructive and most powerful storms on all the earth. And if you want an example of that, all you have to do is think back to storms like Andrew and Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Matthew, or even last year as Hurricane Harvey did $125 billion of damage to the Houston area. All you have to do is think of those storms, and we know how damaging a hurricane can be. And yet, in each one of these storms, there is a place of calm, a place of peace. It's called the eye of the storm. It's right in the middle. All the wind, all the rain, all the clouds are all rotating at speeds of sometimes more than 150 miles an hour around this center. But in the center, it's absolutely calm. Clear skies, no wind, no rain. And for a moment, at least, it seems like the storm subsides. But it doesn't last, does it? Because eventually the eye will pass and the storm will start up again. I bring all of this up because the time of tribulation that we've been studying here in Revelation will be a lot like a hurricane in the world. It's filled with whirlwind and destruction and pain and suffering and a lot of death. And yet here, when we come to chapter 7, we get a break from all of that for a minute. We get a break in the gloom, an eye of the storm, if you will. Everything pauses. And what I mean by that is, if you think back to how chapter 6 began, it started this time of tribulation, didn't it? It introduced us to the Antichrist. He came in on a white horse. He brought world peace, followed by world war. Everyone lines up to follow this guy. They celebrate him. They give him a crown, it says. In chapter 6, verse 2, it says, "I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he came out conquering and to conquer." A couple verses later, it says, "And out came another horse, bright red, and its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth." So we go from world peace to world war. And that world war will destroy the economy of the world to the point it is nigh impossible to survive. A person can't make enough money to provide for a family. It says in chapter 6, verse 5, "And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand." That's the world's economy. That's going to be under attack. We'll see mass inflation. The world will see starvation. And then after that, we find untold death and suffering. It says in verse 8, "I looked, and a pale horse," that's the fourth one, "and its rider's name was death. And they were given authority over the fourth of the earth to kill." That's how chapter 6 starts. And then it continues after the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and we see mass murders of believers. We see the sun turning black, people running into the mountains to hide, and that's how chapter 6 ends. And so you might say that's the leading edge of this storm, which means chapter 8 and 9 are the trailing edge of the storm. There's even more judgment, more tribulation, more death, more pain, more suffering. Listen to how chapter 8 starts. It says in verse 1, "When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour." Imagine that for a minute. Absolute silence in a place where there was just previously worship, because it knows what's coming. It says in verse 5, "The angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. So we have two sides of the storm, chapter 6, chapters 8 and 9. But right here in chapter 7, we get the eye. We get a break. We get a period of calm from all of that. And rather than focusing on God's wrath, for just a moment, we get to focus on God's love. And it's important it's here. It really is for us as believers. Because it tells us something very important, something you should never forget. That no matter what's going on in life at any given time, no matter what storm you're facing, no matter how difficult it can be or how high that floodwater rises, that you have a God that is still at work. You have a God who is still by your side. It says in Deuteronomy 31, it is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will never leave you or forsake you. And that never changes. And so we see that continuing here in chapter 7. And notice how it begins in verse 1. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising sun with the seal of the living God. And he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the earth and sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." There's the peace. There's the calm. There's the pause. And it says in verse 4, "And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." And then it goes on in verses 5, 6, 7, and 8 to list each one of those tribes. You know, one of my favorite verses from all the Bible is Malachi 3, verse 6, where it says, "For I, the Lord, do not change." That's kind of repeated in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, where it says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And I like those verses because it reminds us that no matter what we go through, no matter what storms come up in life, God's love never stops. It never changes. He never leaves us. And we see that happening here because notice how God says in his word in verse 4, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. One of the things this tells us is that God remembers his promises. And it's a promise that he made years and thousands of years and millennia ago to a man named Abraham. Now, if you come to our Wednesday night service, this is recap for you. But if you don't, then you'll remember back in the book of Genesis, God approached a man named Abram. His name would later be changed to Abraham, but he makes a promise with him. He says in Genesis 17, "Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son. And you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him, my promise with him, as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him." And so we see that even in the midst of this tribulation of the book of Revelation, in the midst of the storm, in the midst of the judgment, in the midst of all the death and all the suffering and the worldwide depression and the world war, that even in the middle of all of that, the worst humanity will ever see, even then God remembers his promise. And that's important for us to know because we live in a world filled with broken promises, don't we? Broken promises and empty threats. And if you just think about it for a minute, imagine all the products out there that say they'll just make you look younger. They'll make you more confident. Lose weight. You'll make more money if you just buy this thing. Take the pill and watch the magic happen. You know, sometimes when it comes to that stuff, you hear something so crazy, there's no way you could make it up. I kid you not, I saw a commercial one time, it was years ago, but the commercial kind of went like this. If you want to learn how to get people to send you $50, then buy our book for $50. That's how the world is. Everywhere we turn, it's making promises and breaking them. Whether it's Hollywood or Washington or the marketplace, promises are made and promises are broken. I heard another story of a man, a Canadian man, who set up a website where he would sell for $20 a guaranteed admission to heaven. For $15 more, you could bring your pet. Now, just to be clear, Jesus said in John 14, no one comes to the Father but by me. But this guy set up a website. And it would be funnier, except for the fact people actually bought them. People did. They gave them their credit card information, checks, cash, you name it. They bought the assurance of heaven. And it tells us that we live in a world starving for something real, hungry for something it can trust. Which is why I find this so encouraging, that it says here it was 144,000 sealed from the tribes of Israel, because it reminds us that even in a world you can't trust, you have a God that can't fail. It says in Psalm 105, he remembers his covenant, his promise forever. You know, throughout the Old Testament, there are more than 450 references to the coming Messiah. 450 clues, if you will, prophecies, predictions, promises. Everything from where Jesus would be born, who his parents would be, how he would be raised, his industry, how he would be treated, even how he would die. It's all there. 450 plus references. Now, it's been mathematically shown the odds of one person fulfilling 20 of those is smaller than everyone who has ever been born put together. In other words, there haven't been enough people born on planet Earth for it to have happened once. And so 20 predictions, 20 promises would have been enough to seal the deal, so to say. But then God goes on 430 more times, just hammering home the point that God remembers his promises. And here's why they're so certain. Because when God makes a promise, he's not doing it from foresight like we would be. He's doing it from hindsight. In other words, he's not looking forward, hoping it works out. He's looking backward, knowing how he's worked it out, telling us how it's going to be. Think about the time God promised Israel the land of Canaan. He said, this is your land. This is the promised land. I'm giving it to you. But even before the nation of Israel stepped foot in that land, before they fought a single battle or conquered a single acre, back when it was still a future event that they weren't sure was going to happen, God says in Numbers 27, see the land I have given to the people of Israel. It's already happened. It's a past tense event. You see, we make promises based on what we think will happen. God makes promises based on what he's already done. Which means if you have a need that he's promised to fill, he's already filled it. Even if, from our perspective, it hasn't happened yet. And maybe you're not sure how it'll happen, and you're waiting, and you're wondering. And it hasn't happened yet, and you don't know where the money's going to come from. And you're curious, and you're getting restless. Even in the middle of that, God's already figured it out. The resources have already been allocated. The money is already there. The food is already there. Your account has already been credited. God remembers his promises. And we see him remembering his promises here. Another thing we notice about a God that never changes is he remembers his people. Because notice it says in verse 4, 144,000 from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then it goes on to list them, talking about the promise God made to Abraham. It wasn't just a promise that Abraham would prosper. It wasn't just a promise of wealth and notability. It wasn't just a promise of fame. It wasn't just a promise of children. But it was a promise that no matter what, God would be by his side. It says in Genesis 17, I will give to you and to your offspring all the land of Canaan, and I will be their God. In Jeremiah 32, that gets repeated. And they shall be my people, it says, and I will be their God. God remembers his people. Think back to the story of the man on the cross with Jesus, a thief by his own admission, deserved what he was going to get, hanging from the timber on Mount Calvary, just like Jesus was. The first time he'd ever met Jesus, the only time he'd ever spoken to him. And he doesn't use that chance to ask for his freedom. He doesn't try to plead his case. He doesn't say, oh, but Jesus, you know, they've got it all wrong. He doesn't even defend himself. He doesn't ask for mercy. All he says is, would you please remember me? Keep me in your thoughts. It says in Luke 23, he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus replied, truly I say to you, you'll be with me in paradise. I'll do you one better. I won't just remember where you are. I'll bring you along with me. God remembers his people. You know, this past year at our house, it's been a pretty rough one if you were a chicken. I'm just going to say it. We've lost a lot of chickens over the past year. And it seemed like if it wasn't the cold, it was a predator. And if it wasn't the predator, it was illness. And if it wasn't illness, it was some mystery. But for some reason or another, every one of our hens died. And so I called the place we get hens, and I asked them for more. And this was back in like April. And they said, well, we'll have some toward the middle or end of May. Call back then. We'll put your name on the list. And I said, okay. So I called back in May. And I said, I've just given you a call. You said you put my name on the list. I want to come pick up my hens. And they said, oh, we apologize. We forgot to write your name down. We're out of stock. And I said, all right, well, when is your next flock coming in? And they said, it won't be till September. I said, okay, put my name on the list. And they said, we'll do that. We'll keep your name at the top of the list. We'll call you when they're here. And I said, terrific, no problem. Well, last week, we're about midway through September now, I called them because I hadn't gotten any information, no messages. And they said, we apologize. We forgot to call. We see your name is there, but we're out of stock. And I said, okay, when is your next flock coming in? And they said, it won't be till November. And so we're on the list for that. We'll see how it goes. But it's a frustrating thing being forgotten in life, isn't it? You ever been there? You ever felt forgotten? Felt left behind? Maybe you weren't included in some event or some decision that meant a lot to you. Maybe you find out on Monday morning that all your friends went out on Saturday night. You ever felt forgotten by somebody? Have you ever felt forgotten by God? Maybe you prayed and nothing happened. Meanwhile, someone next to you got blessing they never imagined. Maybe you trusted God to provide and now you're struggling to make ends meet. Maybe you followed when he led you somewhere and now you don't know what to do and you pray and there's nothing but silence. If you've ever been like that, if you've ever felt forgotten by God, it's okay to be honest. We've all been there. You know, I imagine Noah felt forgotten by God. You remember the story of the great flood? I imagine he felt forgotten, and here's why I say that. Noah's going along life. He's 600 years old. God shows up and says, Noah, I need you to build me a boat. There's going to be a flood. Stop what you're doing. None of that's going to matter. It's all going to get washed away. Build a boat. I'm saving you and your family and two of every kind of animal, and I need you to do that for me. So Noah does it. And then some time passes, and you know what? The rains start, and there's an affirmation. And there's the flood that comes, and there's an affirmation. Meanwhile, the whole time, the animals have been showing up, and there's an affirmation. The Bible tells us that when Noah and his family got into the ark, God closed the door. And so there he is again. And so this whole journey, there's been God, and there's been God, and there's been God. But then the floodwaters come, and you know what? Nothing. Silence. And it says, even in Genesis 7, the waters prevailed for 150 days. 5 months of nothing. 5 months of Noah on this ark floating around, wondering if he'd ever see dry land again. 5 months of confusion. 5 months of just standing still. And I say I believe Noah felt forgotten because that verse, the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days, is how Genesis 7 ends. Genesis 8 comes right after that in the very first verse, says, but God remembered Noah. God never forgot him, but I bet Noah felt that way. If you have a relationship with Jesus Christ this morning, God has not forgotten you either. God remembers his people. You might feel like you're floating around life aimlessly, wondering if you're ever going to see land again, wondering if the floodwaters are ever going to recede. You might be in the middle of a storm or a tribulation, but God hasn't forgotten you. Did you know that between the Old Testament, the end of the book of Malachi, the last book in the Old Testament, and the beginning of the New Testament, there are 400 years? Now, in your Bible, it's the turn of a page, but in life, that was 400 years of silence. 400 years. Not one prophecy, not one inspired scripture. All these 450 predictions of a Messiah, and then nothing. And then yet, when we open up the book of Matthew, it starts by an angel showing up to a woman named Mary, saying, God has heard his people. Are you in a time of silence? Have you been praying and haven't been getting an answer that has answered your question? You haven't been forgotten. God remembers his people. And it says here in verse 4, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. A promise made at the beginning of time, fulfilled and kept and remembered at the end of time. And so God remembers his promise. He remembers his people. And that message, that truth, the gospel has real power. Notice what it says starting in verse 9. After this, after they were sealed, after all that happened, after this I looked and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and people and languages, standing before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. I remember back to the first days of my adult relationship with the Lord, and I say my adult relationship because when I was a kid, I was saved, but it was an unbelieving home, and so there was no spiritual growth. It wasn't until I met my wife, and she took me to church, and I went to a church that opened the Bible, that relationship started to take off. And so I say from those days, I remember the beginning of that, and how excited I was. And how on fire I was to tell everybody I could find about Jesus. You see, I had it in my mind that I discovered this thing, like a gold mine. And nobody had ever heard of it. And I was pushy, I'm sure I was obnoxious, but I was passionate. And I was just absolutely convinced. If I just told them it was there, just showed them the book that they've never seen or heard about, their lives would be changed just like mine. Certainly they would respond, because who couldn't? Now you imagine that. Multiply it by 144,000 new believers commissioned by God, marked with his seal, running into the world, telling everybody about Jesus, and you start to see what's going on. That's a passion. That's a revival unlike the world has ever seen. And notice the results of that. It says a great multitude that no one could number. You know, Billy Graham is commonly referred to as the greatest evangelist of all time. Personally, he preached to more than 250 million people or so, about a quarter billion people over 70 years. Millions of people came to faith during his crusades, during his messages. Now, take that kind of result. Multiply that by 144,000, and we start to get an idea what this means when it says a great multitude no one could number. Which brings us to our final point, and we'll close with this. The gospel of Jesus Christ has real power. It has the power to change lives. I believe that. It says in Romans chapter 1, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation. It says again in Romans 10, faith comes by hearing, and hearing the word of Christ. You know, that's why when Jesus was commissioning Peter into the ministry, of all the things he could have said, he said, Peter, feed my sheep. Give them my truth. Give them my word. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He says, nothing else matters. That's the only point. The gospel has real power. You know, I have never met anyone in my life who said they stopped using drugs because some Hollywood actor said so. I've never met anybody who said they stopped using because a politician or a movie or a song said they should. And yet millions and millions of people have been saved. A great multitude no one can number because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's where the power is. And that's the reason that I am so adamant that our church be a teaching church. That's why we have all these different avenues of getting the gospel message out. That's why we stream live to the internet. It's not just to do it. That's why we're on 11 radio stations every weekend. It's not just to do it. That's why we have our Bible college and services on Wednesday night and all the teaching ministries we have going on here at the church. It isn't just to be busy. It's because that's where the power is. And as believers, we're called to share that. To tell the whole world with reckless abandon everything we know about a God who remembers his promise and remembers his people using the gospel that has real power.